programme Jack B. Yeats's sketchbooks and a new director's vision, glimpsing past and future at the National Gallery of Ireland. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. Strong, delicate, swift and true. Market day in Manchester, a woman playing croquet, flowers floating in the Liffey to mark the spot where three people were shot dead by British soldiers in 1914. John Millington Synge resting on a tree. Boxers, horses, actors and the bones of some of his later famous paintings. The sketchbooks of Jack B. Yeats, donated to the National Gallery of Ireland in the 1990s by Anne Yeats, provide a fascinating glimpse into the working mind and life of the artist and a significant visual record of life, landscape and people in Ireland, England and America over several decades from the end of the 19th century. A fine exhibition currently on at the gallery, the sketchbooks of Jack B. Yeats, 1897 to 1955, displays some of the richness contained in more than 200 sketchbooks he kept over his working life. Yeats's paintings, of course, a centrepiece of the National Gallery's collection, the gallery currently undergoing major renovation and restoration. Later in the programme, we'll hear from its new director, Sean Rainbird, on his hopes and plans for this national institution, and from painter Margaret Corcoran on a lifelong relationship with the gallery, both as interested viewer and artist. First, though, the curators of the Yeats exhibition, Donal Maguire and Pauline Swords, and the sketchbooks of Jack B. Yeats.
I suppose when we're talking about the sketchbooks in this context, it's very much the pocket-sized sketchbooks that he carried around. There's lots of other sketches that he made throughout his life. But we have 204 here in the collection, which were donated to us by Anne Yeats, and there are 123 on display. And I suppose people get the bonus of, sometimes it's a double sketch, double page sketch, so you get the bonus of an extra sketch in that sense. And we were a little bit worried at first maybe that there might be too much on display, too much visuals, but as it turns out, people end up spending quite a lot of time looking at individual cases, learning a lot about his life, what he was producing at that time. And we've tried to represent a broad range of his subject matter and his influences throughout his life. In many ways, these represent both his professional and personal life as an artist and as a family man, and so there's a wide range of material and subject matter represented in the sketchbooks, from everything from sketches of domestic life to scenes of horse racing and boxing and many of the other subject matter that he produced
The paintings as well. We see the roots of them here in the sketchbooks. He had a particular sketchbook that he was fond of, a bit like Bruce Chatham with the famous moleskin notebooks. Yeats had one sketchbook that he really liked.
Yeah, now there are a number of different sketchbooks in the room, but there's one sketchbook which he particularly enjoyed, produced by Rowney, and it had this double brass ring. We can see them in the cases here. In many of the cases, they're on display. And I suppose he probably enjoyed it for many reasons. It allowed him to carry it around very easily in his pocket.
But about nine
in dimensions?
Yes.
Pauline's the person to ask there.
They're 9 by 12 centimetres.
9 by 12 centimetres. So they fit really easily in a pocket.
They're for a man's breast pocket, I guess, is where you would have...
In the days when men had good...
Well, you
good
have one,
big breast pockets to go around with. But he was, about 26 or 27 when he started using these sketchbooks, and living in England at the time. What was he doing in those early days?
Well, really, he started keeping the sketchbooks quite methodically after he'd moved down to Devon in 1897. And it was then that he decided to make the move from being an illustrator, which he'd been for the previous 10 years, from when he was quite a young man. So he decided to become a watercolour artist. He wanted to pursue that career as a fine artist. So he then started to keep the sketchbooks very methodically too, because he was a figurative artist. He didn't believe in abstraction. He thought you could really only paint what you've seen. So his first exhibition, which took place in 1897, was Scenes from Devon Life, which he had gathered in those initial sketchbooks in the first few months when he moved down to Devon. And that was something he kept up then in the years going forward, that he'd gather source material for a couple of months, maybe in the late summer, early autumn, and then work that up into paintings over the winter and spring months, and then show again the following summer.
And Donald, of course, there's a great tradition of sketchbooks in art going right back to Leonardo and Rembrandt, yeah. And Turner, I suppose,
use it. There's many reasons why artists use sketches, I suppose. For many, it is a tool for observing and recording the world around them. They use it as a tool for maybe experimentation, trying out new ideas that they want to perhaps try out in more finished oil paintings. I suppose it's a very private space. They didn't have to worry about people seeing it or showing to people. It was a place where they could try out new ideas, explore subject matter that might not necessarily be covered in their oil paintings. And like Yeats, he recorded a lot of his personal life in his sketchbooks as well. But you mentioned artists like Da Vinci and Turner, and it is interesting that the sketchbooks by these artists have become almost considered works of art themselves, and we see them on display in places like the National Gallery and the Royal Academy in London. So it's nice to have this opportunity to, I suppose, celebrate one of our most famous artists and most significant 20th century artists through this medium as well, and put his sketchbooks on display. And the nice thing about sketchbooks are that you get to see what's on the opposite page as well, or you can perhaps even imagine what's on the other pages as well. They are books, as in a sense, and he carried them around and filled them on a daily basis. So while there are a limited number of sketches on display, there are, in this room, throughout the exhibition, there are literally thousands upon thousands of sketches that you can only, as a visitor, imagine what was on those pages. But they are all held in the Yeats archive here, and you can, on request, view the material that's held in the Yeats archive.
Pauline, of course, Yeats was, in a way, almost notoriously private, and he didn't say much or write much about his art at all. And in a sense, through these sketchbooks, we see perhaps more into his own heart and into his private life than we do in his writing, for example.
Yeah, I mean, Jack was so private, he wouldn't even allow a photograph of himself to appear in his catalogues right throughout his career. That level of privacy, he didn't think that it was of benefit to the viewer of a painting to know about the artist's private life or how old they were, you know, even little details like that. So the sketchbooks give you a really intimate look into his private world and a real sense of a very happy marriage and a happy home, particularly for the years that he was living in Devon, which is when he filled most of his sketchbooks. So there's kind of a 10, 12 year period there, but there's a lot of domestic sketches, a lot of lovely, restful sketches of his wife, you know, resting on a hill overlooking a Donegal landscape. That sketch is on in the first display case there. So it does give you that really lovely insight.
And that again, that lovely sketch of her playing croquet.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, you do get that sense of how they enjoyed themselves. There's also sketches of Cotty playing pool, and, you know, these were their pursuits. They didn't have children, and I think in a way that allowed them to maybe enjoy each other's company maybe a little more.
I love that detail as well in the very fine book that accompanies the exhibition, the sketchbooks of Jack B. Yeats, where later on, I think after his wife died, he said that they were like their lives together. They'd been like two strange children who met at a party.
That came to a party and stayed on after all the others had gone. And he wrote that just in the weeks after Cotty had died, to his godson Patrick Graham. That letter is here in the archive as well. So there's an awful lot of very complimentary material in the archive. Even we have a number of sketchbooks here of New York, and there's a lovely letter in the archive that describes his trip to New York to a friend, and you can access some of that material on the app that accompanies the exhibition.
Tell me a little bit about that trip to New York in 1904 and the sketches he made there.
So Jack travelled to New York in 1904 for his first solo exhibition stateside. It was organised by the American lawyer and patron of the arts, John Quinn, who had been a supporter of Jack's father, and Jack had met him in 1902 in Dublin. And then Quinn subsequently became a very strong advocate of Jack's. So himself and Cotty travelled to New York in March of 1904, and he filled, well, 8 sketchbooks that we have. There was possibly 9 or 10 in total while he was there during a 6-week period. But you can really see from the sketchbooks how fascinated he was by the hustle and bustle of New York. And these are, I suppose, quite typical in a way, these 2-page sketches of the quays. And it's really the quays, the docklands of any city that Yeats was attracted to, the kind of gritty working class element. I mean, that's where he would gather material that would inspire him for his art. But you can see this sketch here. It's a two-page sketch of the registry room in Ellis Island. I think this sketch speaks to a lot of people because it is the inspection room where steerage passengers emigrating to New York would undergo a medical inspection. So I think it's quite poignant. On another sketch in that sketchbook of Ellis Island, he spent the day there sketching, but on another sketch he's commented that he didn't see anyone smiling while going through the long inspection process. So it's quite poignant, and I think a lot of people can relate to it, because a lot of us would have ancestors who would have emigrated. Mm.
And of course that interest in the sea, in the maritime aspect of life, was going back to, again, to his childhood in Sligo with his grandparents, and
because
they had such
absolutely.
Strong links to the shipping business.
He was very attracted to the sea, I suppose, both for its symbolism and just he was interested in the nuts and bolts of ships and that kind of thing. But certainly you see it a lot in his sketches, and it appears obviously in his paintings as well. You think of Men and Destiny, paintings like that, and the sea is a huge presence and motif in his work.
And then, of course, the character studies as well. Peter here, this great... was it Peter Gillin?
Oh, Peter Gillin. Yeah. Actually, yeah. The Gillins were a very prominent family of mariners in Sligo. Peter's father was the pilot master at Ross's Point. And Jack would have known him from his childhood there. Like, there are sketches from within the Gillins' home as well. He would have been quite close to those people.
That's the thing that strikes me as well, Donald, that in through so many of the sketchbooks, there's this sense of history, of Yeats capturing the moment. And in a way that perhaps words could not. He can capture ordinary life continuing in the midst of profound change.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. I suppose he did that in the west of Ireland, more so than perhaps anywhere else, throughout his life.
And of course there was the famous 1905 Travels in the West with Singh, and I suppose, again, some of that here to be seen, and the extraordinary, life captured, and this incredibly vivid use of colour.
Yeah, absolutely. He made regular trips to Ireland, and his first trip was in the late 1890s. He began to stay with Lady Gregory at Cool Park in 1899 and held his first exhibition of sketches of life in the west of Ireland in 1899 also. And he continued to travel well into the early 20th century. And in 1905, he toured throughout Galway, Mayo and Roscommon with J.M. Singh, the writer, who was a good friend of Yeats, who he had met through his visits to Cool Park, where really he was introduced to the whole world of the Celtic revival, yeah, and the literary revival, and key figures such as J.M. Singh. And of course, he had access through both his father and his brother William Butler Yeats, who were very much involved and central to this whole movement. But in 1905, as I said, he travelled throughout the west of Ireland with Singh. Singh was writing a series of 12 articles for the Manchester Guardian, and Yeats was invited to illustrate the articles. And so he produced these wonderful illustrations of life in the west of Ireland. They travelled mainly throughout the congested districts, they were known as. These were the poorest areas of Ireland, and Singh in his writing and Yeats in his illustrations represented the hardships of life there and the poverty that existed in these areas. So we can, but at the same time, as you say, there's wonderful colour in them. There are wonderful representations of life in the west of Ireland, and we can see here a lovely one of a market, clothes market.
Stone, yeah. Mullet, it's beautiful.
Exactly. Yeah. We have other ones of another lovely sketch of a Galway basket market, and we have this. He sketched, as I said, you can only see a small selection of the sketches here, but among them we have this lovely sketch of Singh resting on the branch of a tree, and it's one of a number of sketches that he made of Singh while they were travelling together. As I said, he carried this sketchbook with him all the time, sketched everything around him, so it was only natural that he sketched his travelling companion as well. And I suppose it's slightly poignant when you look at it that Singh died only soon after this trip in 1909. He finally succumbed to Hodgkin's disease, which he was suffering from throughout this period.
It's very interesting. We're so used now to looking at photographs that seeing this world, these worlds revealed in sketches, and again he's using, I suppose, graphite and pen, watercolour, all kind of mixing mediums at times. But there's a soft. It does something else. looking at these as opposed to photography. Was it, I think, Donald, you quote Singer Sargent talking about how the sketch can reveal more than any photograph, you know, that it's, it keeps sketching.
Sorry, actually, it's interesting you bring up that was his father, his own father, John Butler Yeats, yeah, who felt that a sketch could never, or a photograph could never be as effective as a sketch, that even in the very way that an artist executes a particular line, that it's almost an idiom in itself, it says something that a photograph can never duplicate. And Yeats, in that way, he had a great, he had an excellent facility, I suppose, for actually for drawing and sketching. And quite often his sketches are incredibly economic in how they're actually put down on paper through his use of line and colour.
Extraordinary facility with line. Absolutely, ability to capture something
in
a few strokes.
And it's interesting to see across throughout the sketches how that develops as well. His change in style didn't evolve overnight. It was a very slow transition, and we can see that taking place in his sketchbooks like we can in his oil paintings. And in many ways, some of the changes he made in style occurred first in his sketches. And we can see that in some of the later sketches and pencils, where often he didn't go to the trouble of colouring them in. His sketches became much more fluid and much more and vaguer as well. And we can see much more fluid use of line in his later sketches, particularly the sketchbooks he made in Dublin. And in many ways, this probably perhaps informed the application of paint in his oil paintings and how he expressed himself through his oil paintings.
Can we have a look at some of the sketchbooks where he, I suppose, again, he was capturing aspects of that profound political change that was occurring a century ago, and he really put, again, managed to capture in a few strokes at times something of the political drama and the change that was happening.
Yeah, he moved to from Devon to Greystones in 1910, and from then on he had very close contact with what was happening in Dublin. He visited Dublin on a regular basis and was very involved in social life and the art scene there, again through his family connections as well. And then he eventually moved to Dublin. He moved to Donnybrook in 1917. So he witnessed a lot of the political and social upheaval that took place during that period. And a lot has been made by historians and scholars about Jack's political interests. And when you look through his sketches, there aren't a great deal of political subject matter. But then again, at moments there is, and when he does express it or convey it in his sketchbooks, it can be very powerful. And this is one sketch in particular I'll just draw your attention to. It's a very rough, vague, but very evocative and very powerful sketch of the location on Bachelor's Walk where three people were killed by British soldiers in July 1914. And it was made just a couple of days after the event. Jack went in and made this very rough sketch, and we can see where some flowers have been thrown on the ground. He says that
girls have thrown flowers in memory of the people who were shot.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, became the source for his very well-known painting, Bachelor's Walk in Memory, which again is an iconic work by Jack B. Yeats. But I think in some ways the most interesting thing about seeing it in the flesh like this, so to speak, it has been illustrated before, is that you get to see the sketch on the opposite page. And in this case, it's a sketch of some people standing outside an antique shop on a Dublin street. So in many ways, it evokes so much about the nature of Dublin life at that time, that life went on, these incidents, very violent, very tragic incidents happened. But as Yeats, who was documenting city life in this way, was travelling through the city, he perhaps turned the corner and made a sketch of a completely normal scene of some people standing outside outside an antique store. And I think that's the great thing about seeing the sketchbooks in this way, that you get to experience, in many ways, Jack's perception and understanding of the world as it played out and played out before him.
Pauline, it must have been really exciting to work on these sketchbooks, you know, to open them, to look, to see what's there, and to explore that richness, because we're seeing, I suppose, a relatively small percentage of what's there, and it is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have an exact figure. There's approximately 8,000 sketches and a couple of thousand pages of manuscript notations. But it was an incredible privilege. I spent almost 6 months cataloguing these sketchbooks, and it's really how I feel I came to know Jack B. Yeats in a way. And it's, you know, it was an extraordinary privilege, and they do give you a real sense, as Donal says, of the world of the time, but also of him and his place in it, I suppose.
Do you have favourites among the sketches that we see here?
I do have favourites. I do have a leaning towards the earlier watercolour sketches. I mean, they're such complete little items. I think later he was using the sketchbooks more as an aid memoir. They're not as worked up. So certainly some of the earlier ones from the west of Ireland would be amongst my favourites.
Because these, as what we're looking at here, so these later, the Dublin ones, are much plainer. They're graphite, they're pencil, and they're not, as you said, they're not coloured.
After 1910, he exclusively pretty much use graphite, but that was also the same time he decided to make the change from watercolour painting to becoming an oil painter. So it's almost as if he threw the watercolours out and said, that's it, it's graphite and oil paint from here on in. But they're obviously still very beautiful, and the draftsmanship is incredible. So still wonderful.
We can see right in front of you here, we have a very beautiful sketch of Derrynane Harbour, Derrynane Bay, which a lot of people will recognise. And it's a good example of how we can see his vigorous use of line. And then, but then at the same time, very delicate use of line as well. In the distance, we can see the skelligs outlined on the horizon. And this became the subject matter for a later painting of Derrynane Bay. Yeats, of course, isn't always associated with landscape painting. And it's something that struck us about when putting this exhibition together, the amount of landscape sketches that are actually in his sketches. And quite often, they're completely void of any human activity at all, as with this sketch. And this became the source for a very important landscape painting, which he made in 1927 of Derrynane, which is an incredibly expressive painting, and which draws on both his memory of the location and the experience of being there, and on the sketch as well.
It's fascinating point to think of somebody with that facility to make a wonderful sketch like this of landscape of Derrynane, with all its associations, and then using that as the basis for an oil painting. I mean, he had this incredible, clearly had this incredible gift, but he also knew, and I suppose that's the most important thing, he really knew then how to use it.
I think it took Jack Yeats a long time to maybe find himself as a painter. There's a letter that he wrote after he painted Liffey Swim, which I suppose is kind of from his middle period, where he said that he felt like he was the first painter on earth. And I think he did find his niche, I suppose, later in life, like he would have been in his 50s and 60s, really, when these sorts of sketches and paintings started to appear. I suppose, like the expressive nature of these, they're almost, I suppose, an emotional response to a scene. They're quite symbolic, I suppose, his later works.
You asked about one of our favourite sketches, and I think perhaps I could speak on behalf of Pauline. We both quite enjoyed this painting. Pauline, I think, first suggested that it was perhaps a sketch of Yeats himself. And so in many ways it could be called a self-portrait, which is quite unusual when you think about the fact that he was creating these sketches for personal use. Why would he include himself in it? But it's very obvious that from the profile that it is the artist himself. And I think what's interesting about it is that it's in a barbershop in Dublin, which the walls of which are covered with the types of ephemera that relate to the subject matter that he liked, things like boxing and theatre. And there's something very intriguing, I think, about the fact that he's sitting in the barber chair, perhaps surrounded by mirrors, aware of his own appearance, and he's now staring into the mirror, looking back at his own reflection. And then it sets up this uncanny dialogue in some ways between us as the viewer looking at him then as well. And so I think that it's interesting in that way, how something so simple can actually be ultimately quite a complex image as well.
I love the title as well, Dublin Rum Old Hairdressers Near the Academy of Hibernian. Rum artist sitting in the barber's chair. Did he continue to use the sketchbooks right up to his death, up to the end of his career?
He sketched less as time went on, but he went back to the sketchbooks over and over and over. I mean, you'll see there's a sketch in that of a sideshow act of a very tall man in that display case there, and that became a painting in 1945, 47 years after it was sketched. So while the sketching diminished, certainly after the 1920s, I think 170 of the 204 sketchbooks we have are pre-1920, so that'll give you an idea. There's only one sketch from the sketchbook from the 1930s when he was predominantly writing. So definitely it diminished, but he continued to mine them for subject matter, composition, motifs right throughout his life.
Pauline Swords and Donal Maguire there, and that exhibition of Jack B. Yeats's sketchbooks continues until May the 5th. The National Gallery is, of course, one of the country's best-loved cultural institutions. Among its regular visitors is painter Margaret Corcoran, who's been reflecting on what it means to her personally.
I'm coming here since I'm little. First on a school trip, and then with my parents and then with my aunt. And on the school trip, I was completely taken in by two paintings, by Rembrandt's The Flight into Egypt and by Chardin's The Governess, which are two completely different painting styles, and I still have the postcards of those little brown National Gallery envelope, and I still cherish them, and they would still be two of my favourite painters. And when I came back with my aunt, and a really special thing happened that I think could only happen here, I can't imagine it happening in a gallery anywhere else, I was six, and I wanted to see the Indian Lady, I think that's what it's called, mostly because of the pearl. I wanted to know how the pearl was painted. And so I came in and I asked the attendants where it was. It wasn't on display, so they pulled back, this is how I remember it, they pulled back this big curtain and opened a door, and they brought the painting out, and they gave my aunt and myself chairs, and we sat there and we viewed this painting for as long as we liked. And that's probably why I especially love it here. Where would you get such treatment at such a young age? Because I think they sense that I felt passionate about the work, and I do think the staff here feel especially passionate about the collection. I mean, earlier today I had to ask the really polite ladies at the door, they're always lovely, was the Goya on display? Not the usual one, but the lady with the mantilla, and it was the lady at the reception, it was her favourite painting, so she was very gleeful looking it up. But I mean, where would you get that? I mean, say you go to a gallery abroad, maybe you'd get a lot of students who are interning, and they're not here for decades. They don't have that same connection with the place, with the city, with the works of art. So it's a very family, I think it's a very family atmosphere. It's a very homely atmosphere. They have a stunning Turner on display at the moment, The Dawn of Christianity, The Flight of Egypt, in the gallery right now. I mean, the frame alone, the frames in many of these paintings are worth a trip, honestly, to the National Gallery. They're exquisite. But this piece is a very unusual piece. It's a circular painting in a square, highly embellished frame, and it's like a rainbow caught in a frame. And I'm talking about this one because when I was in college, a tutor told me that I think I'd asked him how to solve something I was having difficulty with in a painting. And I'm just speaking as a painter specifically here. And he said, look, go down to the National Gallery. And I really think what he was doing was giving me a route to independence, because at some point you do have to leave college and you need to be able to manage. You're going to be working on your own, most painters do. So he gave me this wonderful tool. He said, you go down there, any problem you ever want to solve will have been solved previously by another painter. And I think without exception, he's been correct. That was decades ago. And so, for instance, there was a Goya on exhibit here. It isn't currently. It was a lady with a mantilla. I realised. He's like, Goya had, I think I'm correct, he'd more or less done potato printing with a bit of lace at some point on her. Just because how on earth are you supposed to paint lace? So he just slapped it on and then worked around and worked it in so it looked as if he was, and he is of course highly skilled, but there are tricks of the trade that you can do. The Zurbrand's always very cute as well because of the little squished cherubs. We're at the Masterpieces from Collection because at the moment many of the pieces are either loaned abroad and they're in the middle of refurbishment. So you've got apparently the best of the pieces here. We're just in front of the Zurbarán here. It's a Spanish painter from the 1500s, but it's such a cute piece. And there are quite a few pieces like this in the National Gallery that are almost comical. You know, you've got little globe-like cherubs peeking out from under her robes, the Virgin's robes here. She has this cherubic look herself. And there's a gentleman on the left-hand side there with his eyes completely covered over by a blue bit of robe. If you're a little kid, you know, that's at your height. So it's very amusing, really. And you'll have it then next to a magnificent piece, such as, I think this is a Saint Jerome. Saint Onophorus by Ribera. But this is painting of the highest caliber. I think this must be lead white, which isn't used much anymore. So it sits proud of the canvas. And every fold in the flesh, this is an elderly saint here using his rosary, every fold is painted individually. All the hairs of the beard, it is exquisite with this chiaroscuro background. You wouldn't get a painting much finer than that anywhere else. And then, of course, is the Velázquez right beside it, which is pretty close to perfection. And we have it here in this city. We're really, really lucky. I think there's one other in Chicago. They're of a pair. That's it. These are as good as you can. Oh, he's here. I love him. I used to feed George under him. But when it was rainy in Dublin, I'd sometimes nip in here and feed my daughter because that was 20-odd years ago. I really wasn't done. And I'd often sit under this guy in his lovely pink plumes. And I've read since that he had a lot of children himself, but not always in the best circumstances. He was such a cheery fellow. I'm sure he did this out of vanity, but it's ended up been quite anti-recessional, because these are all free. You get to see all these paintings. The Earl of Belmont, I think. And I would have been feeding George under, quite discreet under my big yellow jumper, and Raven Keefney came through and came over and sat down and said, now don't let anyone move you on. You work away there. And we were both laughing because I said, you know, there's loads of Madonnas upstairs doing the same thing and no one's making any fuss. And I was far more discreet. He's dressed in really pink, luscious satin. This is a Joshua Reynolds. Some people called him Sir Sloshua Reynolds because the marks are just schlepped about like this. But every detail's in place. Look at the sword, all the golden work, and these lovely rosettes on his shoes. So, but you don't expect... I mean, I've never seen a painting of a man in such pomp. It's wonderful. It's more comedy, isn't it? It's very theatrical. We're in room 5, the Irish paintings. This is where they've been rehoused to from the Milltown rooms. There's 3 paintings here that I particularly love, and I actually come in and visit these on a regular basis. So it's Paris Court Waterfall by George Barrett, The Ideal Landscape by Thomas Roberts, and Fisher's, I call it Fisher's Tree, but I think it's a view of Killarney. They're varying in scale, particularly the Fisher is a really small little piece. But these paintings are from a really interesting time in Irish history. They're painted in a Claudian manner, in the manner of Claude Lorrain, but I think there's an awful lot more going on in these paintings than meets the eyes. These are where painters of the time would have been more than just in a patron relationship with people like the Duke of Leinster, the Earl of Charlemont, and Lord Paniscourt. They were friends with them. And at the back of all this is Edmund Burke's treatise on the sublime and the beautiful, and his area was politics. And I'm really fairly sure that there must have been something of Irish identity. I think these are quite... I think my feeling is these are conceptual. There's also some talk that they may have been plein air, which would be very early. And I've worked them into other works, concerns of my own. And then in The Fisher, it's such a quirky little painting because you've got this single little tree all on its own. And I did a little watercolour for my last show. I show with the Kevin Kavanagh Gallery. He's a friendly gallery. And I gave the tree, because it is so solitary here and lonely, I gave it a second tree. It's the same tree, just again, and I called it a friend for Fisher's tree. But this tree is really fascinating me right now, and I wonder, was this tree, if you look at the dates, you've got it, well, it's dated 1797 there, which would be just before the 1798 rebellion. I don't know, I've read in one of the books from the National Gallery that it was painted a bit earlier, but still, I'm wondering if this tree represents a form of national independence. And I found a tree similar right back through to the Renaissance, and even the Tree of Life, which is a whole other thing, that this just this very new tree. It's not a big full tree at all. It's a sapling. It's a new growth. And I'm wondering if something like that has been said, where it's a new beginning, a new order. And so there would have been much talk of politics when people would have been gathering and looking at these paintings in each other's houses. And so I think it's a very hopeful image, although it does look quite wan and like it's struggling a little. I'm hoping we're going to be doing the same, that we will flourish and grow.
Painter Margaret Corcoran at the National Gallery of Ireland, where just over a year ago, Sean Rainbird was appointed director. Former director of the Staatsgalerie in Stuttgart and before that senior curator at the Tate in London, he takes on the task of seeing through the renovation and restoration project at the National Gallery, where despite recent additional government funding, he's working in an environment of cuts, fewer staff and reduced budgets. Did the timing make it more difficult to embrace the role with as much relish as he'd like?
I think that's the reality just about everywhere, to be quite honest with you. I think you have to be prepared for retrenchment. It's not specifically the Irish situation, but of course the recent economic history of Ireland would obviously point fairly strongly in that direction. Beyond that, it needs to be the case that we look at every single euro we're spending, and in the arts we tend to try and spend every euro twice anyway, that we, beyond that, look at how we do it. And I think this is an area where we can improve in terms of the dialogue with our funders, with the officials in the department at a political level, and obviously myself working in conjunction with the board.
And we'll talk about all of those various relationships and combinations in a while. But going back, your own background, born in Hong Kong, you studied art history in German. What prompted or stirred your initial interest in visual art, in painting, and then in the work of curating?
Well, actually, it was quite serendipitous, quite accidental in a lot of ways. I did a lot of music at school, and at one point was debating whether to study music seriously. I eventually took the piano on to quite a high level, but never saw that as a professional path. And when I was looking at that decision, I really loved the idea of doing something within the cultural sphere, if you like, that biosphere. And I was very attracted to linking up art history with another subject, and I began actually studying history and art history, and very soon switched to German and art history, and managed to hit a department at University College in London where a lot of things were zipping along at a fantastic rate, really. There's a great professor John White, who is a Renaissance specialist, and he was very much for literally getting people on their hands and knees in front of the pictures to actually see the material, how this painting is actually made, what's in it. And there were some very cerebral people like Lynn Cook, and those kinds of members of staff were at University College at that time. So it was a fantastic range, a great spectrum, and it was a very exciting time to be doing art history, obviously in a city like London, which is very well stocked with museums and galleries, but not particularly of the kind that I was being moved towards by having taken German. And the Northern European is something which is particularly weak in the UK collections. And so it was very interesting to me to be one of the small minority of German speakers, people interested in the kind of Northern European tradition.
Was there any Irish connection to your family at all? I mean, were you? Did you have an awareness of Irish art, artists, art history before you took up the position here?
The position here, of course. I mean, within the family, my father's Seamus, his mother was Mary. She was in.
Would suggest some Irish connection.
It's from Derry originally, but actually living in southern England. Paternal grandmother actually died a long time ago. She died of cancer and was a heavy smoker, so that's something not to do. And so I never knew her very well. And of course, we came back from the Far East only every two or three years. So we didn't really hook into family so much or so often. But certainly at the Tate, that was my first serious job, if you like, half a working life, 20 years. Certainly there were artists like Jack Yates in the collection, very rarely shown, actually. I think he'd get more of a chance now as the Tate's really opened up. But I remember having very good conversations through the 90s when I was very much more involved with contemporary art, with artists who, well, we call them artists. I didn't necessarily see them in nationalistic terms. So I remember having a wonderful dialogue, buying a great work of Dorothy Cross's way back then, and talking to Willie Doherty and going and seeing fantastic shows. A wonderful one at Tate Liverpool about 15 years ago. And Kathy Prendergast did a really fantastic group of drawings of all the capital cities around the world, which I think has been bought here, which we first showed in what was a new space called the Art Narum. I mean, getting living artists, younger artists, to show at the Tate, which in the mid-90s was actually a very new thing to do. So as far as I was concerned, they were artists. I didn't pursue them because they were Croatians, Irish or Germans or anything else, but they were just good artists.
Pursuit of good art. Those 20 years at the Tate, they must have been both immensely challenging and satisfying, especially then as senior curator at the Tate Modern, to see the Tate Modern emerge as this new force in British and indeed in world art.
It's been a fairly phenomenal set of years, actually, for the Tate, and it continues to be, I suppose, right through the era that will, I mean, Nick Sirota, I'm sure, will see phase two, as it's called, through. I mean, the new build at the back of the existing ex-power station. The expansionary years of the Tate started with Nick Sirota's predecessor, Alan Bowness, who opened Tate Liverpool, who took over the Barbara Hepworth studio and initiated Tate St Ives, and, of course, built the Claw Wing by James Sterling on the one side of what was the Tate Gallery. And you know, Nick certainly had this vision of creating a museum of modern art, which, you know, London did not have, one of the very few capital cities in the world not to have a museum of 20th century then, now 20th and 21st century art. And so I think this is a very, very strong vision, which has been followed through with enormous elan and dogged determination, and has resulted in a very, very exciting institution, very dynamic institution, but one sometimes feels it's dancing on the head of a pin. It just seems to create so much attention and so much good work is done there, and it is a fairly amazing thing to have been part of, to come out of what used to be a more sort of civil service approach, like all the museums were back in the 70s and 80s, and moving through to a much more dynamic form in more recent times.
Tell me a little then about the work you did later then at the Staatsgalerie in Stuttgart in Germany. After London, was that a very different experience?
It was the first time that the Germans had acquired a non-native speaker. If we take the Swiss and the Austrians as native German speaking, at least part of Switzerland, and obviously German speakers, it was the first time they'd acquired a non-native German speaker as a director of a gallery there. It's a different kind of a tradition. There might even have been an element of chauvinism or just our system works best for us, those sorts of things. But it was quite an adventurous step in Baden-Württemberg, which is again slightly looking in two directions at once. On the one hand, everything's always better at home. They have that kind of a mentality. We're happiest amongst ourselves. And at the same time, with firms like Bosch and Hugo Boss and Daimler and all the rest of it, they're exporting globally. So you've got this twin outlook of actually we're cosiest amongst ourselves, and at the same time we're looking outside. And so to acquire that as part of the challenge was very fascinating.
The challenges then here at the National Gallery of Ireland, obviously you're carrying your experience from the Tate and from Stuttgart to the work here. I suppose a different set of challenges. You know, a rich collection. What did you make of the collection coming into it in the first place?
Well, the collection here is surprisingly well endowed, surprisingly rich for... If you start doing other comparisons, if you say, what's the population of this or that of the other country? Ireland kicks in at whatever it is, 4.65 million. Countries of that scale don't usually have such important national collections with the international standard of art that we find in the National Gallery. Obviously, there are connections historically with the way a number of UK collections were formed. that the same kind of aristocratic families sent the same kinds of sons on trips around the Grand Tour, and they came back with the same kinds of works from Italy. All of those kinds of aspects, there are a lot of similarities between ourselves, for example, and the National Gallery. But I think what it's left the National Gallery of Ireland with is an extraordinary richness, really, in the European tradition. Wonderful Italian works. Obviously, the Dutch collection is very widely celebrated. I don't forget, we showed a group of the Dutch landscapes recently, and the Dutch curator, who's also Dutch, who looks after that part of the collection, stood up at the opening and said, well, actually, if you take the top 10, this is something we occasionally do, is the milestone theory, and of the best landscapes, two of them are hanging in the National Gallery of Ireland, which isn't something that people would assume, I think, from afar. But it's a very celebrated part of our collection. And one of the other aspects to point out is whether you know, right from the beginning with the Milltown gifts right through to the Bites and beyond, we've had really extraordinary gifts into this collection. And if you look at the Bite gift from the late 80s, it's not that long ago, but that group of nearly 20 old masters, it is really unparalleled, and I could scarcely think of another institution which has been really blessed with such a benefaction.
Of course, you also came into a situation where the gallery was already facing major renovation, necessary renovation. What state is the building work at in the first instance? Where are we with the building now?
Effectively, one of the roofs has already been done. The Dargan roof is ready. The next phase was to do the Milltown roof, and the third phase is to do the buildings holding up both of those roofs. And so we're at phase two and three, and we're really about to go out to tender at this point. We've had to secure the funding. It's been very, very difficult. At the same time, one has to remain tenacious. I think particularly at times of economic crisis, and I don't think that's an exaggeration, sometimes they're the best kind of times to look at building infrastructure. And that's one of the arguments we made, that this is a real moment where we can provide jobs and enjoy the expertise within the construction industry and keep that activity in Ireland, at the same time investing in the future of a great institution which does a fantastic job of work for aspects such as cultural tourism or tourism per se. We had 660,000 visitors last year. Many of those were from overseas. They all bring revenue into the country. So there are economic arguments as well as, of course, social arguments. We had 90,000 people in join us for some kind of educational activity. Many of those were Irish. So we have many, many communities to serve. And so there are many strong arguments to bring for the building works. Essentially, the refurbishment of the Dargan and Milltown wings is really bringing very, very robust, sturdy 19th century architecture in a condition of 19th century technology into the 21st century. So it is essentially a modernization project. It's about fire control. It's about air conditioning. It's about those kinds of absolutely fundamental aspects of running a modern institution. And so I saw it as utterly vital that we fight very, very tenaciously and have as many conversations as it will take with all our various stakeholders through our department, with the DEPA and with the OPW and all of these various funding partners. The National Gallery is actually contributing from its own resources as well. So there's a trio of funding partners behind this project. So I think it's terribly important that we fight very, very hard to get it done. And now's the moment, really, because I think there is a little bit of a shift. There's a feeling of uptick. There's a bit more optimism. And all that means is that costs will probably go up. And so we have to move now.
Do you expect that the work will be complete in time for, I know you intend, I think, to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the opening of the gallery a year later in 2015. So 2015, 2016 are seen as these key years for different reasons, political and cultural. Do you think we will be looking at that kind of state-of-the-art, modern, renovated National Gallery of Ireland for those years?
I think actually we're looking at 2040, not even 15 into 16. I think the two-year project that we have, if we can get builders, construction workers on the building site by the end of this year for a two-year project, we should be able to take over the building completed by end of 15, I would hope. we then obviously need to commission all these new technologies. It doesn't just open overnight. We have to then hang the museum. That's a process of, you know, 3 to 6 months. So I would hope that early 2016 that we'd be able to reopen. Our anniversary is 2014, and what I'd like very much to do is find ways of celebrating the various stepping stones. We're obviously in this thing called the Decade of Commemorations. There are all kinds of national political celebrations and commemorations to think about as well. And what I've been talking about with the curators is ways that we can respond creatively to these various milestones of our own history, of Ireland's history. And there are ways of doing this, even if we've only got 30% of the galleries open. So we're working very, very particularly on ideas and projects that will celebrate these milestones.
I have to ask you about this planned amalgamation of the boards of the National Gallery of Ireland, Imman, the Crawford and Cork. I suppose, you know, controversial proposal, and I have to say the idea of one board for such diverse institutions certainly does seem questionable and problematic. What's your own position on that? Is it a plan that you believe can work or can be made to work?
I think the conversation around combination is going in a direction, as far as we're concerned, that I can favour. I share the view that just pulling all those three very disparate institutions under one umbrella board would be very difficult to achieve, wouldn't necessarily work very smoothly. But what the initiative has actually unleashed is something quite interesting. First of all, that there is a willingness to speak about which areas can we begin to share on. Are there sensible aspects of running an organisation? And it doesn't necessarily mean the cultural side, the programming side. It could also mean the back of house, the HR and the IT and the financial, those kinds of aspects of running an organisation. Are there sensible things we can discuss? Are there areas that we can cooperate more on or cooperate at all on? And part of this conversation is also to show up the gaps, the deficits, that one institution might be further along the line than others, and others may realise that they need to act. So it acts as a form of kind of taking an audit, looking at where you are. So it's been very useful in terms of that. And I think the discussions have been very, very collegial. And there are areas where we can see very useful overlaps. So I think the discussions are in a good place where we can look at shared services. I think we've made clear that there's very little money to be saved, in fact, that there are structural differences that we won't be able to override in the short term at least, but there are certain areas, you know, around marketing, around enterprise, that we can actually have meaningful conversations about. There may be useful links that we can make to other cultural organisations. So I think as a conversation, it can be very useful, but I think the aspect that is down a particular political channel to say they need to be merged, I don't think would have been helpful. And I'm very pleased that the department listened to the proposal we made to actually talk more about cooperation shared services. And that's been a fruitful dialogue.
Earlier in the programme, we heard the painter Margaret Corcoran say that she believes that the staff of the National Gallery seem to have almost a personal sense of ownership or stake in the institution. Is that your experience from working there now?
Well, actually, that's one of the reasons I'm enjoying working there very much. I think there's an incredibly committed and passionate staff. To use the vernacular, they're really up for it. I think people really want to do a good job. They love their institution. They love their collection. Part of what they're responding to is the fact, and this is another reason I came to Dublin, is that the people out there, our visitors, the people who know us and visit us and hold us in regard, often high regard, have really a passion for this institution. Everyone has a memory of it. It's quite extraordinary. That's always the first thing, as I remember when, and often people when they came in on school trips or when they were playing truant from school, they were wandering through the galleries. Whatever it might be, there are all sorts of very colourful stories about it. And I think the staff reflect that, and they have a great fondness for the institution and really want to do things. And I've noticed that in this period of maximum disruption, where we haven't been able to plan things more than 3 or 6 months ahead, which of course puts your whole gallery news timetabling out of sync and means you can't do as effective press as you'd like to do, we still managed to put on a number of displays from the collection, the Dutch landscapes we talked about, or the artists face to face, or bringing down the Ulster Museum's Turner to put in a room with other religious paintings, or obviously the Turner, the annual Turner pilgrimage. This year we had 60,000 people, more than ever, it would appear, alongside a publication of a new publication on Turner, which is selling like hotcakes. The staff have created that. And, you know, we've begun to show some of our archival collections, like the E8 sketchbooks now. It's a phenomenal thing to have that in a collection, but it's something we need to use and need to show and need to be proud of. And that's the staff doing this. I may have pressed the green button, but at the same time, the staff really want to make these things happen. And I think the resonance, the response of the public has been very encouraging to us. I expect at a certain point, when there are so few galleries open, at a certain point, people will get tired of this. We have to keep things moving. We have to keep things interesting. And I find the staff very, very open-minded, whether they're the people patrolling the floors, the people who greet you as you come in, the people at the information desk, or the curators and everyone else who puts an exhibition together, the organisers and publicising it with the press, and all of these aspects. All of those things, okay, we can make them work better. We're looking at all of these organisational aspects, but it really is the spirit of a place that comes through in the way it's perceived by the public. And my feeling is that the spirit in both directions is enriching.
Director of the National Gallery of Ireland, Sean Rainbird there. And again, the sketchbooks of Jack B. Yeats, 1897 to 1955, that exhibition we featured earlier, continues at the National Gallery until May the 5th. There's also a beautiful book based on that exhibition available at the gallery bookshop. That's it from us. Sarah Binchy produced the programme. From all of us, good night.